Today, the banks have got the major parties by the throat. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and property news. Today, I'm joined by Robbie Barwick from the Citizens Party. Hi, Robbie. Nice to see you back again.
Hi, Martin. Good to be back. Big week in Parliament this week, which I was there for. So I think I've got a good report that people should be interested in.
Well, this is a very important conversation, and it really reconfirms something that you and I have been talking about for a long, long time, and that is that the banks have their arms all around the major parties. They have huge influence through lobbying, through their donations, and very importantly, I think, because of, let's call it, a philosophical alignment, right? So what we are finding is that the two major parties are dancing to the same tune. That tune is being played by the major banks and their lobbyists, and that tune is actually to their benefit, not to the benefit of ordinary Australians and ordinary businesses. And this is now beginning, well, it's getting really, really serious. If we don't do something quite soon, it'll be irreversible.
That's exactly right. And it's not just the banks, of course. There's a lot of examples where, because of each sector of the economy being highly concentrated in a handful of corporations, each of those sectors wield enormous power over the government. But it's, Mussolini called his system of fascism, corporatism, a marriage of government and corporate power. That is what we have in a lot of the world at the moment, especially Australia. But the banks are at the top of that pile. They have the most power, partly because of how important banking is to the economy, which I don't think enough people appreciate. Credit is the lifeblood of the economy. And because we don't have a government bank anymore, which we had for, we've only had 30 years of not having state banks. We've had them for well over a century before that. Governments are entirely at the mercy of the decision-making of the banks in this most crucial area of the economy. They don't have a bank as a tool of their own policy. And that alone is a reason that the governments are on their knees in front of the banks, apart from what you've just gone through, which is the corrupt relationships where there's all these donations and things like the major parties rely on the banks when they run their election campaigns. They borrow heavily to run those election campaigns from the banks. And then, you know, they get their $5 a vote now, thanks to inflation. And then they pay the banks back, and then they recycle it again. And it gives the banks in Australia way, way, way too much power. And what I'd like to do tonight is just give an eyewitness account of my visit to Canberra this week with Dr. Andy Schmulo. And people would remember Andy. He was the Citizens Party's Senate candidate for New South Wales. He's an associate professor of law. He's an absolute powerhouse. Very, very, exceedingly sharp in his understanding of these matters and of the law as it relates to the Corporations Act. And we went there to participate in Senate estimates, which is the couple of times a year the senators ask the government agencies questions. And I'm sure the viewers would be familiar with that. And what we saw in multiple instances, Martin, is that the major parties are on a unity ticket, a bipartisan ticket to protect the banks and the corrupt structures. And the only agitation, the only pressure, the only accountability is coming from the minor parties and independents. And so I hope by the end of what I go through, people will conclude, as I have, the only way we're going to get change in Australia, real change in Australia, is to vote out the major parties and vote in the minor parties and independents. And forget how messy that may seem to be, it's not going to be any worse than what we've got. And in fact, we're going to start getting real accountability, in my view.
Yeah, and just on that, it's worth just reflecting on another point, which is something which many people don't understand. You know, we've been talking about the Reserve Bank and the way that they were pumping liquidity into the economy and the government was spending big. But actually, the most significant inflationary impulse in the Australian economy is the massive growth of credit from the banking system. The banks at the moment are lending mortgages at twice the rate of inflation. And they've been doing it consistently for years and years and years. And it's actually the private credit dynamo that creates more liquidity that then creates more yep. inflation. So yep. it's really important to understand that this isn't just a little academic question about banks and cash, right? This is the fundamental structure of the way the economy works. And it's basically designed at the moment in a way to support the massive expansion of the financial system to the benefit of the financial system. But it actually yep. is not benefiting ordinary people. And so this is such a critical issue. And I get a bit frustrated sometimes when everybody says, oh, no, 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 the banks can go on and you know, lend as much. No, no, no. They create credit, right? Every time they write a loan, they are creating new credit into the system. And as they create yep. the new credit into the system, they are creating inflationary pressures, which translate into higher home prices and to the other things that we're seeing. Unfortunately, the Reserve Bank doesn't accept that way, that model of how the economy works, but it is how it actually works. And, you know, the Bank of England and even the Central Bank in Germany have now confirmed that now this is the way that the banking system works. And in fact, it's the banks who drive credit growth, which drives inflation. So this is a critical question.
And the only reason, Martin, that the Reserve Bank doesn't want to accept that point is because to acknowledge that point means you are therefore then responsible for doing something about it. And that means taking away the power of the banks. And that Section 36 of the Banking Act gives the Reserve Bank the power to do precisely that. Jim Chalmers tried to legislate it away last year. Citizens Party stopped him working with the Greens, but we stopped him. It was one of our victories. But they want they and the Reserve Bank, even though they've got their power, haven't used it because this banking system is like, well, I was just talking to someone a little while ago today, actually, discussing ongoing problems with bank victims, and as this person pointed out, the banking system is a mafia, and we've got to break it. Now. I just want to run through a few examples because we could talk all night about this. And we've been talking for 7 years, as you said. but I want to run through a few examples because I think it's quite, people need to see what I saw this week. So the first example isn't actually specifically about banking. It was, and you may have touched on some of this with John Adams on your other channel there. Because John Adams came up in the hearing, but it was the Senate Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee hearing with the Attorney General's Department and discussion with the NAC, the National Anti-Corruption Commission. Now, I want to play a few videos as we talk about this tonight. I don't have this one. I encourage people if you're on X or X Twitter, go follow Senator David Shoebridge's account. And scroll through and look at the clips of his questioning of the NAC, the National Anti-Corruption Commission. But I was so happy that I was in the room where this hearing took place. And I would say it was the most dramatic hearing of the week, this NAC hearing. And I want to say something now. Now, I'm the Citizens Party. I am certainly not the Greens. I don't hate the Greens as people, but I'm not like the people who sort of rant and rail against the Greens and whatever. But I'm happy to acknowledge I have strong disagreements with them on some of their core things, but we do overlap on a similar view when it comes to the financial system and the banking system. And like the other non-major parties, the Greens are not beholden to those corporate structures, and they can do a damn good job. And in this case, this is not so much about banking, but Senator David Shoebridge, who is a barrister, he was extraordinary. He is one of the most qualified people in the whole of Parliament, and he's the perfect person for Senate estimates and actually holding these agencies' feet to the fire. So he gave the NAC a thorough grilling over the fact that Paul Brereton, the NAC commissioner, who people may remember is already under a scandal in relation to robo-debt. There's a series on SBS at the moment, but robo-debt was a crime, an utter crime. And as it became clear how bad it was, the government people involved, including the politicians Scott Morrison what's his name, Roberts, his buddy Roberts, and the secretary of the department, they doubled down on the crime, and people died. Thousands of people's lives were ruined by this thing, right? So this, you know, this is one of the things referred. There was a royal commission, then it was referred to the National Anti-Corruption Commission. And Paul Brereton is a friend of the secretary of the department. And even though he didn't make the decision, the claim is that he didn't make the decision for the NAC not to pursue a corruption investigation to Robodebt, he was in the room when the decision was made. And how is he a friend, the department secretary or the ex-secretary, her name is Catherine Campbell, how is he a friend with Catherine Campbell? Well, they both are senior officers in the Australian Army Reserve. That's how they know each other. And you can see plenty of pictures of them online. So this reality led to further scrutiny of Brereton. And in a previous estimates, David Shoebridge asked the NAC, oh, quick aside, Martin, get this. Paul Brereton has appeared before the Senate estimates. I've seen him. But he wasn't there in this hearing. And the CEO of the NAC was, so he's the commissioner. He's the top guy. The CEO was, it's like a little structure like ASIC, right? I actually don't understand why they structure these things this way. But anyway,
the CEO was. They can then do this.
That's right. So Malcolm Roberts said, Senator Malcolm Roberts said to the CEO, Philip Reid, why isn't Paul Brereton here? And Philip Reid said, I am the accountable entity. I'm the accountable officer of the NAC. So riddle me this. Why is the commission, isn't the commissioner the top dog of the NAC, not the accountable officer, official? Right? This is strange, but I think you've captured it, right? Anyway, deliberately set up this way. By the way, anyway, I'll state it in advance. What this hearing proved to me is the NAC is not a watchdog against corruption. It was set up deliberately by the major parties to be a fig leaf for corruption.
Yes.
And the way this hearing proved it is because a week before this hearing, after the NAC had said to Shoebridge in the previous hearing that Paul Brereton has no ongoing duties with the Australian Defence Force, which is why, you know, is there any more conflicts of interest with the Defence Force? Not just to do with Robodebt. There's a lot of corruption in Defence Force. There's scandals in the Defence Force involving people going from defence and working for the big four account consulting firms, et cetera, and taking their information with them and all this kind of stuff, right? There's lots of scandals to do with that. So you can't have someone who there's so much money being spent in defence. There's lots of scope for corruption. You can't have someone in charge of the National Anti-Corruption Commission who's going to have conflicts of interest. So he was told in previous estimates, no, Paul Brereton does not have any ongoing duties with the Defence Force, except the week before the hearing, the news broke that Paul Brereton is, in fact, he has an ongoing advisory role with the Inspector General of the ADF in relation to the war crimes trial investigation that he did, where he confirmed the leak from David McBride, the war crimes whistleblower, who's now serving a 5-year, 7-month sentence in jail. And by the way, quick aside also, David McBride's a friend of mine. On Friday, tragically, the High Court refused leave for David McBride to appeal that sentence. So here's the whistleblower in jail, Paul Brereton. Paul Brereton conducted the inquiry back in 2017. He confirmed the war crimes had taken place, but he explicitly said in his report that the chain of command should not be held accountable. And so this is what McBride was opposed to. He only wanted the soldiers to be held accountable, right? This is like Baker Morant all over again. And McBride was saw red, and he was railing against that. He still is. But anyway, long story short, this is a guy who's there to cover up for powerful people. That's what his whole record has shown. And then it turns out, yeah, he has this ongoing role. And so there's David Shoebridge. He is grilling the NAC over this. And they are dissembling like mad. This guy, Philip Reid, dissembling like mad. And I kid you not, Martin. Now, we're both old enough to remember the famous immortal words of Bill Clinton, the second most famous thing he said. After he said, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. And a few years later, when he got completely caught and had to confess, he said, It depends on what your definition of is. Remember? Well, Philip Reed, the CEO of the NAC, said to had a quibble with David Shoebridge. It depends on what your definition of duty is. And poor David Shoebridge, he's got a dictionary out, he's reading up all the synonyms of duty, etc. It was just utter garbage. And what these people didn't get, and Andy Schmuller was in my ear because he is a law professor, he's whispering, sorry, Andy, I can't remember the Latin term, but he gave me this Latin term that basically meant if you're in that role of the National Anti-Corruption Commissioner, you have to be seen to be squeaky clean and completely above reproach. And yet, in that hearing, the NAC looked like the dodgiest agency of the federal government. It just made a total joke of the idea of an anti-corruption watchdog in Australia. Now, why am I giving this example? Because I want to get onto some better ones. But why am I giving this example? Because I was in the room. I got to see the body language of what was going on, which you don't see on the camera. And this is what I saw. There's David Shoebridge. There's David Pocock, Senator David Pocock, the rugby player. There's Senator Malcolm Roberts. And then there was a host of Labor and Liberal senators. The three independents and minor party senators, Shoebridge, Pocock, and Roberts, were the ones that were questioning the NAC and zeroing in on this. The other senators just sat there, half of them just fiddling with their phones, completely unengaged and uninterested in this massive scandal about what is the integrity of our Anti-Corruption Commission. That tells you an enormous amount. They set this thing up as a bipartisan plot to create a fig leaf for their corruption, not a watchdog against it. And it really does illustrate in that instance, just how, on the take the major parties are with these structures. And we'll get to the banks in a second.
Yeah, and just to say that John and I made a show recently about process corruption, right? And basically spoke about the fact that this is rife across the way that Parliament works and all of the various agencies and the way that they actually do things. They do things for the sake of doing things, not because they actually want to get an outcome that's different. So you can go around the houses and you can appear to be doing things, but you're not really doing things. So this process corruption problem is absolutely rife in Australia, and this is an example of it, in spades. And the major parties are part of the problem. They really are part of the problem. They play the same games. And so it's not surprising that trust in Parliament just is getting degraded because people just watch this and say, this is ridiculous. This is nothing to do with real decisions and real outcomes. And people get caught in the crossfire in the process, and it takes up a lot of time and energy and effort and taxpayers' money and all that. But it's not designed to get an outcome.
No.
It's designed
And
deliberately not to get an outcome.
Malcolm Roberts, in a second line of questioning, asked the NAC about John Adams' complaints to the NAC in relation to ABC bullion and ASIC. And in the immortal words of the NAC, John Adams will never be satisfied. And what they actually showed, they revealed real prejudice, which they're not supposed to have,
Yes.
but they have real prejudice against John. And I'm fortunate enough, and you are as well. Because we know him so well, we can vouch for the quality of the submissions that he makes.
Oh,
I've
yeah.
made a few submissions to the NAC myself, mainly just to make a political point. Nowhere near the quality that John Adams puts into his submissions. And yeah, that was their response to what Malcolm Roberts said. Now let me move on because I want to give you these other two examples. This was our work. So the citizens, we went there because now, despite all the good things I've said about these the minor parties' independence, they not to put them down, but they do not focus on these issues with the same laser-like quality we do. When it because we have identified that it's this it's you know the economic cr crisis is the principal crisis in Australia. It defines everything, and the corruption of economic policy is what you've got to fix up, and you've got to take on this corporate power, which is stopping democratic accountability. Right? That's the problem. The political parties are too obliged to these corporate vested interests rather than the people. And so when both of them are in on it, that's why when it's a bipartisan racket, then all the voting in the world won't change it. Like switching between major parties doesn't change anything, right? So that's why we're focused on that. I personally think you can get off onto other things and it just becomes a huge distraction, right? And in fact, when you look at a lot of those other things, it always goes back to this core problem anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. So we had some really strong things that we wanted the senators to ask various government agencies to hold them accountable in these areas. And I want to focus on two. We'll play a couple of clips. But first one is branch closures. And, you know, as we spoke about last time and as, you know, we've worked on for a couple of years, we had a great Senate inquiry 17 months ago, handed down its report. The government has just ignored the report, hasn't said boo about it. And then because of that, that gave Bendigo Bank the green light in July to announce first 10 branch closures, five of which are the last bank in town, and then 28 agency closures, 17 of which are the last genuine banking services in their towns. And that has devastated so many places, including the place that I got most involved in, which is Queenstown and Tasmania, which I consider the most egregious bank closure of all, equal to Cooper Pedy, which, remember, Martin, was the first one we got involved with,
yep.
Right? Because in the case of Cooper Pedy, those poor guys have to now travel 540 kilometres to the next bank. That's on a dead straight road, though. The people of Queenstown, they've got to travel 150 kilometres, which is much less, but it takes 2.5 hours because it's a very twisty, dangerous road. And they've even got a Facebook page in Queenstown dedicated to updates on the status of the road because it's such a worry. And now they've got to travel there just to do their basic banking. And then, as you saw, that we got a bit of press coverage on this week because the bank closed 2 weeks ago. And twice, not once, but twice, the local post office, which has Bank at Post, where Bendigo told its customers, go bank at the post office, it has twice run out of cash, twice. And they've put up signs, please. They've put up signs to people to ask them to come and deposit. If they're going to deposit cash, come and deposit in the morning so they'll have cash there to be able to do withdrawals in the afternoon. And in about a week or so, Martin, Queenstown starts its annual unconformity festival. It's a massive festival. Thousands of people come to town. And it must be pretty big because I've seen that one thing about Queenstown, they've got these massive motels. I got to stay in one. I couldn't believe it. Like, he's just so many rooms. I couldn't believe it. It's because it's to accommodate this kind of stuff, right? The tourist season. And a lot of cash is required. And they're going to have one post office that keeps running out of cash and one ATM that charges $5 for withdrawals, right? All because, and you know, Bendigo Bank will be paying rent on an empty building there until July next year. They couldn't even delay their closure by 3 or 4 weeks to accommodate the unconformity festival. This is what a terrible corporate citizen Bendigo Bank is. And the government has said nothing. So anyway, I wrote these follow-up questions. We've tried to get questions up in Parliament, and Colin Boyce, you and I talked about him last time. His own National Party blocked him from putting up a question in Parliament. The National Party says, oh yeah, we're leading on bank closures. No, it's all talk, I can tell you. They're not doing jack shit. They're blocking their own people from actually taking action on this. And so I thought, well, Senate estimates, let's get some questions up for Senate estimates. So I wrote a series of questions. You're about to hear them. And then I tried to get someone to answer them. Now, I approached Tassie senators first because although there's not the closures of more than just Queenstown, Queenstown is so bad, you know, I wanted to make sure Queenstown was highlighted, get someone from Tassie to ask. Now, again, we'll show a clip from Nick McKim in a sec. Nick McKim would have asked, except he had a scheduling conflict. Right. So he's one, the Green Tassie senator. I got nothing back from any other Tassie senator, not at all, including Senator Tammy Tyrrell, who is an independent, but she's sort of like a, unfortunately, anyone associated with Jackie Lambie on this subject has been very disappointing. And I couldn't get anyone to ask these questions. And so eventually I approached Senator Tyron Whitten. Now, Tyron Whitten, people thinking, who? Never heard of him. Well, you will, because he's brand new. So that's the only reason you've never heard of him. He's not a nobody. Tyron Witten is the new One Nation Senator for Western Australia. And when I approached him, he jumped at it. Yeah, I'll ask him. And I think it was probably ended up being his debut at Senate Estimates, actually. And he put the Treasury and the government on the spot with these questions. So now we've got them on record with what they're going to say, which I'll talk about in a minute. But before we play the clip, I also want to point out, look in the background, you'll see over to the left-hand side at the in the gallery section there, you'll see Dr. Andy Schmuller sitting there monitoring the actual exchange. Because I mean, this is how I got to meet Andy through the Senate inquiry into bank closures, right? He made powerful recommendations. They were adopted as recommendations by the committee. And so you'll see him there sort of monitoring how this questioning went. But as you're watching it, I want you to also notice something else. To the left of Senator Whitten, who's asking the questions, well, immediately beside him is Sean Bell, who's the other new One Nation Senator from New South Wales. And then two chairs away from him is Tasmanian Senator Richard Colbeck. Now, I want to say two things about Richard. One is he's a Tasmanian Senator, and he said nothing about what's happened to Queenstown. The other is he served on the Senate inquiry into bank closures in regional Australia. Remember, I was the only person to attend every hearing of that inquiry. He attended at least half of them. I even complimented him in the last hearing up in Tom Price. I said, "Senator, you've gotten better." And he said, "Oh yeah, when you start these processes, you're a blank slate, but you learn as you go." And he was clearly responding to the passion of the people in these towns who were terribly upset at losing their banks. And so he sort of, now I'm starting to think he's just a chameleon who was adapting to the circumstance at the time. Because as a veteran of that inquiry, it's doubly bad he said nothing about what's happened to Queenstown. Not one word has he said about what's happened to Queenstown. These guys, they do this politics for show, Martin, absolutely for show. And so it took a Western Australian senator to advocate for Queenstown and Tasmania. Because he's not in a major party. The senator who did is not in a major party, right? And therefore is happy to look at the national interest properly. Anyway, let's run the tape. It goes for 10 minutes, but I think it's worth watching all of it, and I'll make a few comments after that.
Senator Whitten.
I've got some questions on rural and regional banking closures. But to start with, it's been more than 16 months since the ARAC committee released this report on bank closures in regional Australia. Has the government given a response yet?
So, Lynn Kelly, oh, sorry, I've already done that. The government hasn't formally responded to the recommendations of the task force.
Sorry, I'm quite deaf, so you might have to yell a little
Sorry,
bit.
I'm too. No, the government hasn't formally responded to the recommendations of the task force. However, the government has taken the recommendations in consideration in a number of the initiatives that have been announced subsequently. For instance, there was an announcement in February the government made around a moratorium on major bank branch closures in regional and remote Australia. Likewise, the government announced in February commitments from the majors to renew their contracts with Bank of Post.
Yep.
Right, likewise,
I'll
the.
come to that if that's
Oh,
okay.
okay.
Yep. The ARAC report recommended an expert panel be commissioned to investigate the feasibility of establishing a government bank. Has Treasury considered the recommendation?
We have provided a summary of the recommendations to the government.
Considering a government bank
So we
specifically?
have, as often is the case after a report is handed down, we provide a summary of those to the government. We haven't provided advice in relation to that recommendation.
Okay. On July 24 this year, Assistant Treasurer David Molina stated in Parliament that government has secured access to banking services in regional Australia. And I quote, "Banks have a responsibility to regional communities and we're holding them to it." That was 3 weeks after Bendigo Bank announced the closure of 10 branches, including five. that are the last banks in town. One of these was Queenstown in Tasmania, where the branch was the last branch on the entire west coast. The closest bank is now 150 kilometres away, but it's a four-hour round trip to get to a bank. On the same day, the Assistant Treasurer's speech, Bendigo Bank further announced the closure of 28 branches, 17 of which are the last genuine banking services in their towns, including Cunderdin in my home state of WA, with a 120 kilometre trip to their closest branch. What has the government said or done about Bendigo Bank's closure spree? Did the government talk to Bendigo Bank about it?
I think it sounds like more of a question for me, Senator Whitten, than the officials. We'll come back to you about... I don't know what the engagement between the government and Bendigo Bank post their decision was. I'm very happy to provide that on notice. But, of course, the government's approach here, as I think you indicated in your question, has been about securing that moratorium on bank closures until, I think, the middle of 2027, strengthening the bank at post capacity. We're absolutely aware that not only is there a question in regional communities where people have to travel for banking services, particularly people who require cash, for or to make deposits, or to to do all of the things that people have a legitimate expectation that they are able to do. But of course, the decades of bank closures that happened prior to that meant that not only are people apprehensive in communities about what a closure might mean for them, but there are people who are experiencing challenges in this area and have been for quite some time. So the bank at post reforms is designed to strengthen, doesn't completely resolve all of those questions. And then the moratorium is an important step too, and government will continue to examine the approach here.
Okay. Given the taxpayer-funded privileges banks enjoy, including the financial claims scheme guarantee of their liabilities, which materially boosts their bottom line, should they be expected to provide a service to rural and remote communities in exchange?
Well, Senator, that's asking for an opinion. I would just note we do have a major bank levy that applies to the five biggest banks in Australia, and partly reflects some ways that you can think about it as it relates to the market perception that they'll be seen as too big to fail. So there is a mechanism in the system that actually levies the major banks.
Yeah, I think the question is taxpayers fund something for banks and they'd like to see something in return, particularly in rural and regional communities. In the Assistant Treasurer's 24 July speech this year, he stated... And we've helped secure a number of new agreements to shore up the vital services provided by bank at post. This was a reference to the deal announced in February that ANZ would sign up to bank at post and be accessible by October 1. That hasn't happened. Why?
So we're not party to the commercial negotiations between Australia Post and ANZ, but what I do understand is that ANZ have agreed arrangements with Bank at Post in terms of the key terms of their joining Bank at Post, and now they're working through the logistics of systems talking to each other.
So you may not be party to one side being a commercial transaction, but you would be party to the taxpayer-owned post side, perhaps?
Through talking to our counterparts at Australia Post, we understand that they've reached agreement with ANZ around the key terms, and they're now in that process piece of the ANZ systems have to talk to the Australia Post systems. And I'm not an IT person, but I understand there needs to be some bridging of systems to actually get it functional, and that's the stage they're in.
Is there a time frame for people that have to drive 4 hours to do banking?
So I understand that it's occurring now across December.
December?
Yes, again, but I'm not party to the commercial arrangement, so it's my understanding of timeframes.
The official can only do her best. Obviously, the
government's watching it closely, but she's trying to relay what is the agreement between those two parties. It's not something the government is a party to, it'll be better if it was October. December is better than January. You know, we want to see progress on that agreement being delivered upon, as we do with the range of other agreements that are out there at the moment to try and make sure people get decent services in these towns.
Okay. Hundreds of residents of Queenstown called and messaged the Prime Minister and the Treasurer in August, asking them to intervene to save the bank branch. The PM's office referred the messages to the Tasmanian Premier to answer. Who has constitutional responsibility over banking, the PM or the Premier?
It sounds like a good question for the Attorney General's Department. We've all got responsibilities, Senator Whitten, and government of Tasmania will have an active interest in regional development and economic infrastructure in right across northern Tasmania. We're in live discussions with them all of the time about these kind of questions, and I reckon that the Premier would have been delighted to receive that correspondence, and we'll look forward to hearing about his response.
Look, lastly, it's more of a statement than a question. The people on the west coast of Tasmania are driving 4 hours for banking. This the Shire of Ashburton has no banking. There's so many small towns around the country that are looking for some assistance. I'd suggest that if we could put the pedal to the metal on this bank at post issue, would be appreciated by many, many Australians. Thank you, Chair.
If there's anything additional that we can provide in terms of where bank at post is up to, we'll do that. Thank you.
Well, Robbie, that was quite amazing. And you can just see that the issues that need to be discussed, they don't want to talk about, do they?
Nope. And look at can I also point out the talkative guy on the table is Senator Tim Ayres. He's the government minister. So what happens in Senate estimates to have a minister at the table to help protect the agency and officials from political questions, right? Someone point scoring at them. But you'll notice that if you know Tim Ayres, I've seen him perform many times. He's quite a thug. He's someone who loves just, you know, punching back. Until those latter questions, he was extremely sensitive on this subject. What that tells me is they all know that this is a universal subject. This is not something like climate change where both sides have taken alternative positions. They love whacking each other. It's not like that. They're all painfully aware of what a big issue this branch closures is. So if someone like him, who prefers to be a thug and really muscling up and knocking back at people, can be so sensitive in the way he answers the question, that really tells you something. And then look at what happened right there at the end. I kept the tape going that much longer because what you saw is Senator Richard Colbeck lean over and shake Sean, but you know, the One Nation Senator's hand. Now, I'm looking at that. My only interpretation, Martin, is that's embarrassment. He's done that out of embarrassment. I mean, those guys just sat there next to him and showed him up. Why isn't he talking about the bank in his state? Right? So out of embarrassment, he goes and shakes their hand to make it look like he's somehow in solidarity with them. But, of course, the fact is he's said more by saying nothing than that handshake. He's a stooge of the banks. That's the bottom line. Right? Until they're prepared to take them on, these guys are selling us down the river to the banks. Now, quickly, let's move on to the last clip. This is only 5 minutes, but this is Nick McKim confronting ASIC over ANZ. And there'd been quite a bit of discussion about ANZ. Actually, Martin, a couple of weeks ago, there was just after ANZ got its fine, there was a Parliamentary Joint Committee on Corporations and Financial Services hearing, and this was really dredged up big time there, and people like Barbara Pocock from the Greens went after Joe Longo for not holding the executives to account, the individual executives, you know, they claim it's a big fine. So Andy Schmulo, because he's a professor of law, had given Nick McKim these powerful questions that actually showed how in the law Longo had the power to enforce sanctions both against the company in relation to what they did to the government and against individuals, right? And so Nick McKim is pressing the point, and it's just worth listening to. And he asks three questions. He asks, why weren't heavy sanctions taken against ANZ? What about the individual executives? And then lastly, and this is the sting in the tail, he asked Joe Longo, essentially he asked him, when you leave, because Longo's going to retire next June, you might have heard, Munn, it'll be sad to see him go. when you leave, are you going to go work for a bank? That's what he essentially asked him, and you get to see Longo's response to that as well. Anyway, just have a look at that.
Senator McKim, I'm assured you have two questions.
Yeah, I'll be very
given
brief.
We're quite behind.
Thanks. Just first one to tie off on the ANZ matter. I mean, Mr. Longo, can I ask, did ASIC specifically investigate, during your investigation, did you specifically investigate whether any individual person at ANZ, like, for example, the chair or the CEO, failed to take reasonable steps and whether they therefore could have been disqualified as an accountable person?
I'll do my best, Senator McKim, but the investigations into ANZ were not conducted under the financial accountability regime, so I'm just trying to confirm, are you referring to a particular provision within the...
Yes.
Yes, so the financial accountability regime commenced for the banking industry on the 15th of March 2024. Almost all of the conduct that makes up the various ANZ matters that are the subject of this series of court actions predated that, Senator. So we didn't consider the FAR regime as part of that investigation. I can say, and I was going to swing back to this just to say to you that yes, there are various challenges associated with joining individuals, as Mr. Longo has outlined, as liable for the acts of corporations, but that is an issue that the financial accountability regime was introduced to try to redress. We are a co-regulator with APRA in relation to that regime, and certainly we are actively, when we're investigating these kind of matters, now considering FAR-related contraventions. Okay. Both agencies are. We haven't had an action yet, Senator, but I can assure you that we are actively considering it and actively engaging with financial institutions. Both agencies are, under the terms, if you like, or in accordance with some of the financial accountability regime obligations.
Right. Thanks for that, Ms. Court. Mr. Longo, final question to you. It's already been referenced that you've announced that you'll not be seeking to renew your term. Would you regard it as a conflict of interest if, like, there's a term, the revolving door? I'm sure you're familiar with it. It applies in this place, much to my frustration and the frustration of my party. Would you regard it as a conflict of interest for you to leave your current position and walk into to a role in an entity like, for example, a big bank that you're currently regulating? Would you regard that as a conflict of interest?
I finish up at the end of May next year. My priority is to do my job till then.
Yep.
And from the 1st of June, I'm going to have a break.
Well, I'm sure it's well deserved.
I'm going to answer your question. I'm going to have a long break.
Okay.
And I'm very familiar with the issue that you're raising. And the committee can have a reasonable expectation that I won't be doing anything like that for quite a while. But I think it's important to acknowledge that I absolutely accept the premise of your question. I've been chair of ASIC by then for 5 years. I plan a real break. I do not plan to leave public life, but I'm very conscious of the need to preserve the dignity and independence of my office, whoever is in it, and to not do anything which will undermine confidence and the integrity of the office. I feel that very strongly. I've lived my whole professional life according to those principles. The only other thing I would say is we're silent on this in Australia. There's no, even the convention that I've just tried to talk about isn't written down anywhere. But I am very conscious of the point you're raising, and you'll just have to wait and see to whether I conduct myself in accordance with those sentiments.
Thank you. Well, once again, it's the same old, Robbie, isn't it?
Look, this guy Joe Longo, I was actually, just as we're watching that, Martin, it occurred to me, you know, we've been at this for so long, we've now our relationship is longer than the tenure of an ASIC commissioner.
Yep.
Because we remember when
James
he got appointed.
Shinton,
So when he got appointed, the AFR, the Financial Review, said Joe Longo is the business friendly regulator that Josh Frydenberg craves.
Yep.
And to the end, what he's done with ANZ is the example of that. And the way he was, I can assure you, legally, Nick McKim is right. Longo is wrong. The lawyer in charge of ASIC is wrong. He does have the power to stop ANZ from getting a government contract with the Australian Office of Financial Management, which is what they did the dirty on when they did this manipulation of the bond sales. And he does have the power to hold executives to account, because as he said, what he said at the end is, oh, that, because ANZ has, as part of the settlement, this $240 million settlement, admitted to not having sufficient systems. I forget the exact wording, but that is grounds for taking on executives under the Financial Accountability Regime Act, the FAR Act. So that's what Nick McKim was zeroing in on. And Longo saying, no, the FAR Act is for individuals. What he's saying is ANZ is admitted as a corporation. It didn't. But the point is, a corporation without people is just a building or something, right? It's if the corporation is confessing to not having the systems in place, there are people who are responsible for that. And corporations, and you probably know this better than I do, corporations have a map, an accountability map.
Mm.
Where you can, Longo says, oh, there were hundreds of them. We couldn't sort of zero in it. No, they have an accountability map. If there's hundreds of people, you could actually pinpoint, okay, who are the hundreds of people? Well, this one, and this one are responsible, right? Throw the book at them, disqualify them. They've committed unconscionable conduct. They've robbed the taxpayer. They've stolen from the dead, done these things that were raised at the Royal Commission. Throw the book at them. And of course, they absolutely won't. And he speaks it so smoothly. And then at the end, he's basically, you know, we should take what he said at the end there in his answer to us, to a senator in a Senate hearing, that he's not going to go work for a bank. But you'll notice he put in enough dodgy words that don't be surprised after he takes his little holiday at the end of June that he ends up working for a bank again. Because, Martin, that's the way we do things in Australia.
Mm. Yeah,
right? That's the system here.
Mm.
We're so corrupt, we don't even know we're corrupt.
Well,
right?
it's process corruption to the point where everybody just says it's just a normal way. In fact, the crime is not the corruption. The crime is being found out, right? But, you know, it goes on all the time. And just want to remind you here, you know, when that Royal Commission into the conduct of the banking industry came out, one of the things they were trying to get to was to get executives directly accountable for things, right? There was a thing called the bear, right?
Yep.
And that has gone completely, absolutely nowhere because of all of the pushing and shoving from the banks. Oh, we can't possibly do that. It's impossible, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so we've got the situation again where we've got this sort of shibboleth of a bank, but there's nothing underneath it. There's nobody who says, yes, it's my fault. There's no accountability. There's no accountability for any of this stuff. So whenever, you know, people actually have their savings whipped away, or when they get charged for things they shouldn't get charged for, or even dead people get charged, no one is held accountable. And that is a disgrace.
That's a system.
But it is designed like that. It's a deliberate structural edifice that's been put in place to allow the banks to do whatever they want to do to maximize their profits without taking any account of the impact of ordinary businesses and ordinary Australians as they go about their business. And that is the disgrace here. That is the ultimate disgrace. It means that the parliamentary system and the two major political parties who are in the bank's pocket will do nothing to protect ordinary Australians and ordinary businesses from, frankly, what I regard as pretty much criminal activity in some cases. And in fact, it was admitted through the Royal Commission. There was criminal acts done. Nothing was done about it. And nothing is being done about it because of process corruption.
Well, I want to give you one more example and then I'll make one final comment because I want to give you an example of criminal activity. And this is the power of Andy Schmulo, I'll tell you. So as we got to Canberra, the Deloitte scandal had really erupted. The Deloitte scandal is Deloitte got a contract for $440,000 to write a report for the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations, et cetera. They used AI to write it. and the AI did this thing called hallucination, which is worth looking. If you don't know how it works, look it up. You should never trust AI. So they used AI to write it. It created fake references, and they submitted that as their report. And the day we arrived in Canberra, Deloitte had owned up to it and said it was going to refund. It had fixed up the report and was going to partially refund some of the fee. Now, the people we talked to, none of them, people like Senator Barbara Pocock, were nobody was happy about that. And even Labor Senator Deb O'Neill broke ranks with her own party to say that all the money should be taken off Deloitte. And but Andy Schmulo made a very important point, and we'll see if this goes somewhere. But the point he made is this: a government department is only supposed to outsource to a consulting firm like the Big Four, like Deloitte or PwC or whatever, if that firm has technical capacity that the department doesn't have, right? And that's the basis on which Deloitte bid for this contract. But the fact that it used AI means it didn't have the expertise that it claimed it had. It used AI instead. It cheated in order to get that $440,000, close to $500,000. And Andy Schmulo's point is that is a crime. Deloitte obtained a financial benefit by deception. The people involved should be charged with a crime, right? Not just refund part of the money. No, let's call this stuff for what it is. That is a crime. They ripped off the taxpayer by deception so they can make money, because that's, they think it's their damn birthright to rip off the taxpayer like that. And that is the kind of change that we need in Canberra. People like Andy who can bring that kind of clarity to clean this crap up. And so my final comment is, I'm sort of expressing my own experience here, and you and I've discussed this a lot anyway, but look, tonight I have talked about One Nation and the Greens and a couple of independents, right? And if you put them all in a room, they're not going to agree with each other on many things. And you personally, the listener, if you're watching this, you will have your own. You might be a real fan of the Greens and hate One Nation, or you might be a bit. If you are a fan of the Greens, I'm sure you do hate One Nation. If you're a fan of One Nation, I'm sure you do hate the Greens, right? I don't know what your view of the Citizens Party is or whatever. You might have a view of David Pocock, positive or negative. I hope you know about the David Pocock scandal also, where he pointed out that the sports club of parliament is a lobbyist for the gaming industry, and the only genuine sportsman in parliament has been kicked out of the sports club for doing what Jesus Christ did in the temple, right? So clearing out the money changes. Anyway, but whatever your view is, understand that what we're talking about is the overarching framework, and you should actually be happy when it's a green even if you don't like them, or if it's a One Nation, if you don't like them, that's taking on the structures. Because you're never going to have a perfect world where everyone agrees with you. You want to politics is always going to be in a contest of ideas. But if the structure is corrupted, that contest of ideas doesn't work. And what we're building is a coalition of people who will want to take on the structure that is corrupting the process, so that we can clean it up, so then you can have proper democratic accountability, and then the contest of ideas can work. But unless it does, that's all futile, and you're just, you know, screaming into a gale, right? And that's, to me, that's one of the real lessons I've learned in my sort of engagement in politics. And maybe it's helped sort of being much more of an outsider even than the other minor parties. And I've gone in there trying to work with everybody, right? There's no point making, you know, you find common ground and you work with them, because I'm not trying to pick fights on what I disagree with. I'm trying to find common ground on, hang on, we can all agree that the structure of the system has to be clean, right? Let's work together on that. And I can tell you now, outside the major parties, it's a unity ticket to try and clean that up. And people should cheer that on and keep voting in minor parties and independents in that process. And if the Citizens Party is running in your electorate, vote for us, because, again, not to put the other guys down, but we do have the focus, the laser-like focus on this that not even some of those other parties have. But nevertheless, they're all doing, in this area, they're doing a pretty damn good job.
And I'll just make a couple of philosophical points, because philosophy is about the why question. But why does this happen? But why does this happen? But why does this happen, right? And you get to the point when you go down that route of realizing that there is a basic set of problems which are actually structural in nature, which is the way that power is actually working in Australia, and the way that the two major parties in particular are being sort of cajoled by the banks and other large corporates. And in a way, the discussion about policies from all the parties is a mirage, right? Because you can have these sort of policy discussions, you know, up here somewhere, but underneath it, if we don't get this structural issue actually tackled, nothing will change. And it doesn't matter actually who you vote in, because nothing will change. And so if you want real change, and I think there are a lot of people across Australia who believe that it is time to think very differently about the way things work, we've got to get this process stuff attacked. Yep. Step one is to shine the light on it so we can see it. And then step two is to actually get it changed. And this is a very important conversation, Robbie. And it's, as I said, it's not just about the cash problem with, you know, in a community, although that's a very important symptom, and I could go through a lot of other symptoms. But there is a root cause issue at the heart of Australian politics. And it's hard as black at the moment, because they don't care. They don't care about the fate of ordinary Australians and ordinary businesses. And that's a problem. So we have to change it.
Yep, that's the plan. Anyway, we'll keep at it, and the Citizens Party will always stay engaged on these matters. So, and we'll keep your viewers, especially Martin, updated.
Wonderful, Robbie. Thanks for that, and I'll look forward to the next conversation, which I think will have to come quite soon, because there are so many things out there that that need an attention.
Oh, one last thing for those who've hung around this long, can I just a quick pitch for the party? We're on this membership drive, and we have a deadline to get registered in New South Wales by next month, and it's a bit of a process in New South Wales to get registered in terms of paperwork. So you got to do a lot of organising of people to make sure it happens. Anyway. If you're someone who's been following the Citizens Party for a while and supports us, and you're not a member of another political party, please join. Go to our website, citizensparty.org.au, sign up as a member, especially if you're in New South Wales, but anywhere in Australia, right? Join the party. We're on a membership drive to get to 10,000 members as our first goal. But this acute need to get registered in New South Wales is very important. So please get on board, and we'll put you to work too.
Thank you, Robbie. That's very important.
Thanks,
links are below, and we'll catch you again soon.